Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The year is 1980. Sydney's streets are filthy, running rampant with crime and corruption. Puberty Blues is on at the cinemas, Ice House is blaring on the stereo, it's humid and dangerous, and a young man has decided to join the police force to fight crime. That man, of course, is my dad. Loose Units, the podcast, was created to tell the cases that wouldn't fit into my first book, Loose Units. But Loose Units was a series of fantastical tales that I wrote based on the real crimes my dad solved on the force back in the early 80s. So this season, Dad and I are finally going to go back to the year 1980, and each week we'll be going chapter by chapter through Loose Units, the book, and Dad will tell us the story behind my version of events. It'll be thrilling, revelatory, and as always, very, very loose. Welcome to Loose Units Origins. Hello and welcome to Loose Units Origins. Every week I, Paul Verhoeven, sit down with my dad, John Verhoeven, and we go through some of the cases I talked about in my book about him, Loose Units. And we've kind of reached this sticking point. I think, Dad, we are just about halfway through the book. How does that feel?
Feels good. Really good.
Something wrong with your throat?
No.
I like how you always save your kind of throat clearing until your first line on the show.
Paul, you are prone to exaggeration, and there is a classic case of it.
Would you like me to go through the hundreds of hours I've edited together,
Paul,
and play you a montage?
Paul, the funniest thing, when I was in Melbourne with Christine, we were down and we visited you and Tegan. One of the funniest things that I'm still dining out on, it's a classic, and that is that you often mimic me and you think you are so different to me. But then you thought perhaps you were 50-50, 50% from mum's genes and 50% from mine. But Tegan, because when I watch you, I see myself, which is a bit weird, in terms of your mannerisms, but you actually thought you were sort of more like your mother, but Tegan said, actually, no, you're more like your father.
Yes, but so, she would also say that to wind me up, because that does wind me up. She knows how to push my buttons.
But Paul, you should be honoured and thrilled that you're like me.
How would you feel if someone said you're exactly like your father?
That's below the belt, Paul. That's
No. I'm this is not a crack. I'm deadly serious, because you clearly, because you're raised by people and you inherit traits from them. So it makes sense that you would absorb some stuff from your dad, but then your path through life has you changing that stuff and kind of reworking it.
But you can choose. If they're negative things, you can choose to reject them.
You can try, but sometimes they're going to creep through, right?
Fuck, Paul. Oh, God, you're funny. Anyway, it's like you're sort of saying that being like me is not so good.
No, I'm saying there's pros and cons, Dad. So I literally said I did a talk for a library that you and Mum tuned into a couple of days ago,
and it was bloody marvelous.
Thanks. It was really fun. It was over in Bunjil Place, over in Victoria, and I was asked whether I was. I believe they asked me whether I was anything like you. And I said, well, what I've tried to do is take the traits that I really like and kind of, you know, draw on those and, you know, kind of course correct and build my own identity out of that. What I'm trying to say is that there are some aspects of you which I have built my entire personality on. And that's, I think, a serious compliment. And then there's got to be stuff about you that you're not, you know, super in love with.
that you would hope that would get ironed out, right? There's got to be, you know, everyone's got to have their own stuff that they work in. I'm not just taking things from you and mum. I'm obviously absorbing things from friends, from, you know, from the world around me. I'm informing, but the DNA of my personality, there's definitely a lot of you. There's a lot of you in there, but Tegan, Tegan knows what to say to get a rise out of us. Yeah. And it worked. It worked. Yeah. So no, in a way, the person at fault here is Tegan.
But I, look, I've always believed that, like, I think I've mentioned this to you and the listeners in the past, but my mother, she, whenever it came to the good traits of, for example, me, she would always sort of align those traits with her side of the family. Have we had this discussion?
Yes, I think you brought this up. Or when it came to negative stuff, it was always down to your dad's.
And always my father.
Yeah.
Which I think, and my father, rightfully so, used to sort of look a little bit sort of sad and think, well, hang on a sec, that's just actually impossible. But I also think with bad traits that if you begin to realize they're coming through in your own personality as you grow, if you're not happy with them, you have two options. You can ignore it and just go with the flow, which I think is really, really bad. And I think that is one of the problems with parenting, insofar as if you've had a bit of a rough trot as a child, being sort of, you know, overly disciplined, for example, or overly strict parents, which was the case in point being me, and my mother never agreed with the way my father disciplined me. She never agreed with it. And, you know, I could have been like my father with you three kids, but I made a conscious decision to break, sort of draw a line in the sand. And both Christine and I had very, very strict upbringings, overly strict. I mean, my youth was so fraught with sort of rules and regulations that I simply did what a lot of kids... I mean, you either had two options. You could either comply, be complicit and go with the flow, or you could do what I did and be a total rat bag and sort of rebel, which I did and loved.
But what's interesting about you is that you... as listeners know and readers know, there are many times in which there are many ways in which you have deliberately gone, look, there's some stuff about the way I was raised I don't like. I'm going to run in the opposite direction and I'm going to raise my kids no curfews and really kind of let them kind of forge their own paths, right?
Yep.
But what's really interesting about the whole loose units thing is that it always struck me early on that one of the narratives I threaded through the book was you kind of looking for a mentor slash father figure, not necessarily a father figure, but, you know, like a mentor to someone to kind of guide you and raise you and give you the kind of approval and the guidance that you so clearly deserved, right? Because everyone wants that kind of, you know, everyone wants a mentor, I think. I mean, I would love to have a, you know, growing up, I wanted kind of cool older people who could inform my taste and, you know, impart wisdom and life lessons and stuff like that. You know, teach me how to do karate. But it looks like going through loose units, you sort of had this bum run of kind of crappy mentors. I mean, you were stuck with Len Beater and he was awful.
Yeah.
You got paired up with Ant-Man. You know, he was just violent and an absolute bully, like a tyrant. And the reason you gelled with Julian is because you both agreed that that was a kind of shithouse way to go through the police force. And the reason this next chapter strikes me as so timely is because it's called So Sue Me, and it's basically about your very brief stint with a mentor called Sue. And I thought it was so interesting to see what happened when you were paired up with a woman and an older, like a woman that was older than you. I think she was like 10 years older than you at this point. Mum actually was friends with Sue, and last night Mum sent me a photo which we can post on the Facebook page with Mum's permission. If it's not there, it's just because Mum's gone, please don't post this, as it's private. But Sue was ostensibly... Can you describe what Sue was like as a person?
Well, firstly, it needs to be noted that Sue, which is her real Christian name,
Yeah.
And Mum, Christine, were in the same class together. Now, Paul, this is a little bit kind of not weird, but I think it's quite fascinating, and that is that Sue was 10 years older than Christine.
Sure.
So by default, she was 10 years older than me, because Christine and I are pretty well the same age.
Well, Mum's older than you slightly.
Slightly. Yeah, yeah. But the thing, Paul, is that Christine, because I chatted with Christine last night. I said, look, Paul has asked me to go into the deepest recesses of your mind and try and come up with some stories, you know, about your relationship with Sue. And Christine brought up some lovely photographs, really great photos of Christine when she was 19, which is incredibly young. And but photos of her and Sue and all her other... Because in Christine's class at Redfern Police Academy, there were at least 10 women. But two of the women, Christine and Sue, were both posted to North Sydney, being the first two females ever in general duties to work at North Sydney Police Station. But Christine admired and looked up to Sue because Sue was 10 years older, but Sue had come from a very senior role in banking. And when they did the typing, Christine was telling me last night at the academy, you know, you had to have 30 words per minute on these ancient, and I mean ancient, typewriters that are probably now in museums, if any of them have survived. And Christine very, very proudly said that she typed about 80 words a minute, which is phenomenal, with virtually no mistakes. But then Christine last night told me that Sue typed over 100 words a minute with little or no mistakes.
And that's because of the banking background?
The banking background. But also, you know, she was 10 years older, so let's say she was near 30 at the academy, and Christine felt that she just was a really wonderful role model. I mean, if you are 20 and someone's 30, they've had 50% more time on earth than you. And in that 10 years, there's a vast sort of array of experiences that can sort of prepare you and better you for this amazing career that both Christine and Sue are involved in. So when Christine, you know how they, I don't know whether you know, but it's a little bit like in the film Legally Blonde, when they're all waiting to find out who got a posting to a really good law firm, and it comes out in the university, you know, on a notice board, and that's how it happened at the Redfern Police Academy. That was the day where all the recruits, in my case, there were 170 or so recruits. In Christine's case, there would have been, you know, well over 100 recruits, and they all sort of jostle and sort of, you know, try and get close to this board. And then on the board, it tells you on that fateful day, when you're finishing your initial training, what station you'll be posted to. And Christine and Sue were both posted to North Sydney Police Station. So by the time I started, you know, a year later, once I'd finished my buddy period, which was getting to be probably 15 or 16 months after Sue, so she was sort of, once you'd finished your sort of 1 year, you know, you would be the senior person on the car.
Yeah.
And then I just finished my 12-week buddy period, and I was I was a bit sort of jaded, I suppose, because I'd got to see some of the amazing buddies, the 10 people in my class. 10 of us went to North Sydney in one hit, males and females. And I was, you know, Paul, and it's in the book, how I felt about, I thought I'd been given the short straw.
Yeah.
But that was good. I'm pleased that happened now, because it, and meeting Julian, of course, and already being fairly mature insofar as figuring out what I didn't want to be. It's like you go into an organisation, like you at Triple J. You know, you would have seen people that you would have thought these people are, this is who I want to be. I mean, obviously you want to be an individual, but you aspire to greatness, hopefully. Not everyone does, but there would have been people at Triple J that you would have thought, nah, that's not really my, that's not how I'm going to work. And same in the police. So finally, I got to work with Sue. And she was six feet tall.
Yeah.
She dressed immaculately. She had short hair. She was, I mean, even the way she held her folder, there was something about it. It was a little bit, it almost had an air of kind of a senior officer in the military.
Right. You know,
very proper.
Why do you think she had that kind of, because I mean, she, like I said, in the book, it was more dramatically interesting if I kind of obfuscated that fact that she was in the same class as Mum, right? I mean, it was, because I wanted to give a kind of, you know, mid-career Noni Hazelhurst, like Jackie Weaver-esque vibe. I wanted someone who was just older, wiser, you know, kind of a bit hardcore and didn't take any stick.
Mm.
But, and what is technically true that she is older, like you pointed out. But,
yeah.
But the way she carried herself and her assertiveness was more down to her as a person and her life experience, as opposed to her actual rank, right?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, okay.
She, in my opinion, I think it's fair to say that she demonstrated the attributes of someone of far higher rank.
Yep, okay.
And because there were people of rank at North Sydney Police Station that quite frankly didn't deserve the stripes that were sewn onto their uniforms.
Sure.
But back in those days, we had a really weird system and it carried through into the New South Wales Fire Brigades when I was there, and it's simply called Next Cab Off the Rank. It didn't matter whether you were an incompetent pedophile psychopath with who never ever ironed their uniform and was overweight and slobbered and spat when they spoke. They, if they were next cab off the rank, they got the promotion. There was no promotion by merit, which is scary.
That's odd.
Think about some of the absolute freaks that made their way up in all the organisations. And then over a period of time, they saw the light. And they began to, and here's something really controversial, they actually used to promote people by merit. And I know that the Police Association and definitely the New South Wales Fire Brigades Union, in the very beginning stages of this concept, God help us, of actually getting the best people into the senior roles.
Yeah.
Because quite frankly, Paul, some of the people that I, for example, some sergeants in the New South Wales Police Force in the 1980s were, I'd need to refer to a thesaurus to come up with a few new words, but you would shudder when you worked with them. I mean, honestly, I worked with a sergeant at every single pedestrian crossing we pulled up at. If there was a girl walking past, he would wind his window and he would just say things that made me want the front driver's seat of the police car to devour me. It was horrendous.
Right.
And that was, and I just, when I worked with people, and you had no choice, you can't say to a sergeant or the roster sergeant that rosters you to be, that's the thing about policing, once you got out of your buddy period, if there were 100 police officers at North Sydney, you would be working with 100 police officers. And it was just random.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
So that fateful day when Sue was standing there at the counter, it was an afternoon shift, and I thought, wow. But I began to realise that, and I stick by my feelings to this very day, and I've said it before, and I'll say it again with great sincerity. And that is that there were police officers, women, that you would have felt safer with when the shit hit the fan.
Right.
And that sounds bizarre. But, you know, it didn't matter whether you were male or female. The concept of policing is the concept of policing.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And I have seen and worked with women that were quite frankly phenomenal.
Could you tell me a bit about what it was like to, I mean, it seems like that's the kind of person Sue was. Could you tell me a bit about your first shift with her and what it was like to work with her?
Yeah, it was an afternoon shift and I was like a coiled spring. I mean, I've always been like a coiled spring from the minute I was born, I think.
You should sell springs on the merch shop.
I'd like to sell springs with a tiny little face, my face on the top of it. But I just have this boundless energy and I think Sue realized that. And I'd had a shitty buddy period for 3 months and I thought, wow. And she just looked fantastic. She looked sort of like a regimental sergeant major. She was just immaculate. You know, I remember her shoes were always, you know, just spotless. She had stockings. They had those weird sort of tight-fitting light blue skirts, which were completely impractical, for as Christine has pointed out. And she said to me, okay, now, you know, make sure, because there were certain things you had to do at the commencement of the shift. You had to go to the computer, you had to do a printout of the hot list, stolen cars, the last 20 stolen, the last, you know, back then it was probably in the last 20 minutes, there'd been 50 cars stolen. Sydney was out of control with car theft. And you would read all the telex messages. Telex is a word that maybe some younger people might not be au fait with. And, you know, you just had to sort of brief yourself and be prepared. And know and make sure, and seeing I was the driver, I had to make sure the car was full of fuel, I had the logbooks, I had the radios, made sure the batteries were charged, checked the car for that no prisoners had left anything secreted, particularly in the rear of the car, and basically walk around the car, make sure the sirens, the lights, headlights, because it was an afternoon shift, so it had become dark during the shift, and really just make sure, and I knew that she absolutely expected the very, very best. And I may have even gone out and opened up the door for her, which I think she thought was a little bit odd because she liked to believe that we were all equals. But I was still, you know, I've always liked opening the doors for people. And it was a busy road. It's the highway. It's you know, it's the Pacific Highway. It's super busy. So being the driver, you had to walk around the car and sort of be a little bit careful getting into the car. And off we went. And I remember driving up Pacific Highway. And it's in the book, Paul. And it's such. And I occasionally think about this particular little incident that I will relate to you all. and that is that we pulled up at a set of lights, and I was desperate to show her that I was keen, observant, astute, you know, all the things that I believed she was and she would have expected me to be. And I remember we were parked at a set of lights somewhere in North Sydney. It was a pretty busy area. And I saw through the corner of my eye someone sprinting, like dashing. And I became hyper alert. And I said to Sue, I said, "Sue, this guy, look, he's running." And, you know, in my mind, he'd obviously done something wrong because he's running. And then sweet Sue looked at me in a sort of a knowingly, kind of almost motherly look. And she said to me, "John, it's raining." And then I realized that this particular guy was just running to get out of the rain. And it was a great, it was funny, but it was also, it kind of made me realize that, yes, you've got to be observant, but you've also got to be keyed in. And it made me realize that, you know, hasten slowly. So I sort of backed off a little bit and felt a bit, you know, ridiculous.
Yeah.
But later in that shift, we got a call from through VKG that there was a car accident. It was an accident, no person injured, one car involved.
Yep.
And we rocked up and it was in Cammeray and there was a young girl. She would have been probably maybe 18 years of age. And when we got there, there were three or four tow trucks with the associated drivers that, as you say, were, you know, tattooed. And these guys were all standing around this. And it was a little bit like, if you can imagine, like a stunned doe, as in D-O-E, sort of being on a road with three or four sets of headlights just staring at this tiny little deer.
But and what's weird is, Dad, previously in the book, this has happened as well. You've encountered, and you talked me through, and I wrote about tow truck drivers kind of, you know, seizing upon a vulnerable person and sort of haranguing them. And I feel like, do you feel like what you did next was a direct result of having Sue around? Were you trying to impress her? Do you feel calmer with her there? Did you feel more? Because what you did here was kind of cool.
Mm.
And you know how sometimes you rise to meet the greatness of the people around you?
Mm. I agree with you, Paul. And what I did, which I will explain to the listeners, you know, it could have backfired.
Yep.
It could have been absolutely horrendous. And I still to this day can't believe that everything went so calmly. And as per the, what I did was pretty uncool in a way. But this young girl was being basically threatened by these three or four guys that had, you know, just kind of come out of the primordial ooze, like come out of a sort of a tar pit, you know, knuckle dragging, heavily tattered, really, really heavy dudes from three or four prospective tow truck companies, and they all wanted to get the tow. And it was very upsetting because they were intimidating and really, really scaring. And this poor young girl, she did not know what to do. And thank God she would have thought, golly, the police are here. And, you know, we needed to sort of to settle things down. And they were basically just sort of thrusting forms in her direction, because whichever one she then ultimately signed, I guess the guy that, you know, made her the most scared, because none of them used charm, I can assure you. And Sue walked up and she was really sort of, you know, giving some of these guys a gobful. And she took no shit from anyone. And it was really, really good. But I kind of felt that the situation wasn't really, you know, it was getting more and more heated. And then I'm starting to think to myself, golly, this actually could escalate. And so there were various things going through my mind. I guess the thing that went through my mind the most was whether or not I'd have to ultimately perhaps call a signal one, because it was really getting very heated.
Right.
And I just had this sort of brain snap. And yes, you're probably right, Paul. There was a part of me that felt, I guess I was inspired because of the situation, yeah. And also the perceived vulnerability, and I don't like bullies, and there were three or four real bullies, you know, real standover guys, and I just thought, this is really uncool on so many levels, and I pulled my baton out, which was a mother of a baton. It was about, it was metal that had a knurled handle. I mean, if it came into contact with a bone, for example, the bone would break. I mean, these were pretty full-on batons. And I remember I walked over to these guys, and I've just kind of come through, and the group spread slightly, and I took out my baton, and I held it sort of behind, and I just gave it about a 180 degree arc, and I drove the baton with full force down onto the bonnet of one of the tow trucks. And it just, I mean, like in a cartoon where someone, a character hits something and then the vibration goes through the object and into me. And it was like a bone shattering vibration. Yeah, and I just brought the baton down, and there was this massive noise, and everyone just sort of stopped and looked at me as though I must have looked as though I was possessed. And then everything just kind of just basically died away. And Sue then said to the guys, one of you's got the toe, sort it now, or it's going to be on for young and old. And it was great because what I did, and then the tow truck driver, this guy, he was really pissed off because I'd actually dented the front of his tow truck. And I kind of thought to myself, John, your life might end right now. This could be the last shift you ever do before you get choked out and whatever. But it didn't happen. And just sort of, it knocked the wind out of the sails. And I think I have a feeling that I almost gained a little bit of respect. And I think Sue was quietly, I was shitting myself. I thought, she's going to be really pissed off. But she wasn't, and she was really, you know, she gave me a sort of a very discreet smile and a bit of a thumbs up, and we sorted it. And that was my first shift, and I went on to work many, many, many shifts with Sue, and I just had deep admiration for her incredible, you know, knowledge, and she was so professional, and she took no shit, and she was bloody marvellous. And I'll tell you what, in a brawl, she would have been better than half the blokes at North Sydney.
What are you basing that on?
On just her attitude, her demeanor, her physicality, she was strong, she was fit, and she was bloody marvelous. And then when we got back to the police station, I basically, this girl, this young woman, got out of another car, like an unmarked car. And she comes up to Sue, and they hug each other. And Sue says to me, this is Christine. And I looked at Christine, and of course we know who Christine is. And Christine had been working in some squad, playing clothes undercover, kind of, it was called the Romeo Squad, and they were investigating, young girls that had been sexually assaulted in the inner city.
Yeah.
And how's that? Sue basically introduced me because they were friends.
So, Dad, what happened to Sue later in life? I mean, sorry, well, you know, what happened to her throughout her career? Did you keep having run-ins with her? Do you know where she ended up?
No, but I do know this, Paul, that she could have gone all the way, you know, right up into the mega ranks. She was so great. But she also would have made a mind-blowing detective.
Right. Because
back in the 1980s at North Sydney Police Station,
mm-hmm.
there were ultimately quite a few women. It was really well balanced. It was bloody great. And but I do recall up in the detective's office up the road, there were between one and two females in the detective ranks, which is a really, really small number. But Sue ended up marrying quite a wonderful senior ex-country police officer. Obviously, or not obviously, but in those days she took his name, his so her surname changed.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't sort of follow, but considering how old Christine and I are now and how old she is in comparison to us, she's
probably required, retired, right?
Yeah, and I'd say she would now be at least, I can hardly say the number, but I'd say 70.
Okay.
So long retired, and sure. But she was an asset and a credit to the New South Wales Police Force, and as I said, and as I've always maintained, there were female police officers in the New South Wales Police Force that when you saw that you were working with them, you knew that it was going to be a great shift.
Yeah.
Without sounding, oh golly, there's really no other way of saying what I'm about to say, listeners, but, and just take it for what it is, and all just remember the time, the 80s, where there were a lot of rednecks and rough and tumble, and it was just a totally different scene. It was exciting. It was thrilling, but it cannot be compared with policing today. It was another time, and there have been lots and lots of, you know, stories and films and you know, it's a very well-known time in Australian policing. But it was not uncommon for a female police officer in a really heavy situation to definitely be able to kind of, what's that word, Paul, where you can sort of take the heat out of something?
Defuse?
Defuse. Excellent. Mm. And that was just really, really good. And I think that even some crims, when they saw a police officer who was a female, I'm quite sure that some of their really, really basic sort of primal instincts would sometimes just kick in, and all of a sudden, you know, they'd go, look, I think men, dare I say it, and I'm not speaking about today, everyone, but I'm speaking about 40 years ago. I think it was great, and I think it was really good. And I know that I went to a lot of domestics, so many. It was terrible,
right?
And I think that it was just bloody fantastic to have a female. And you know, again, I reiterate, I don't want this to be misconstrued in any way, but I think you need, I mean, let's face it, in the world we have 50-50, approximately, 50% men on the earth and 50% women on the earth. And I think in policing, I think it's very important to also, you know, demonstrate, you know, to be realistic in terms of representing society, seeing the whole, because let's face it, it is a cross-section. You want it to be a cross-section. And when you once you get into that organisation, you can then begin to get a sense of what you feel would be sort of more suited to your aspirations. I had an opportunity to join the very, very beginning, the genesis of the Tactical Response Group, now known as the Civil Disobedience and Riot Squad, and every state's got them. In Sydney, we get around in massive black four-wheel drives. And, you know, if they rock up to a job, you know that it's going to be a little bit serious. And Julian and Dave, the other Dave, my diving buddies,
yeah,
they both were in the inaugural class of the TRG.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they used to regale me with stories. I mean, incredible stories, but it just didn't do it for me. You know, I didn't really fancy fronting up in a riot situation, like a heavy, heavy siege or something, and having the shit kicked out of me. That just wasn't me. I preferred to be, you know, kind of behind the scenes, although I did love frontline work. Don't get me wrong. I really loved it when Julian and I used to work together, which is later down the track, story-wise. Mm. You know, we were a tour de force in terms of policing.
Yeah.
But again, I think the female aspect is just terrific.
Well, I'd like to kind of touch back on the Sue stuff later on in the season, but that's all the time we have for this week's episode. I also am going to check with Mum and see if it's okay to put Sue's picture up, because I'm so curious to see where she ended up, given how much promise she showed in the police force. So I guess, Sue, if you're listening, feel free to get in touch and let us know. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed this episode of Loose Units Origins. This week, Dad and I are going to do a Loose Ends as usual, so have no fear. If you want to get in touch, facebook.com/loose units is the best way to drop us a line. We'll try and answer some questions at the end of the week. In the meantime, be good to each other and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.